Ghosts, UFOs, cryptids, life after death. You'll hear great thinkers on these subjects and more on the Paranormal Podcast, the longest running podcast of its type. I'm Jim Harold, and I invite you to join me as we explore the mysteries of life. I bet you love these topics just as much as I do, but don't worry, I won't tell anyone. Join me for some great paranormal conversation. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Due to the graphic nature of this investigation and trial, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of murder and sexuality that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. On the night of May 4th, 2001, newlyweds Bonnie Lee Bakley and Robert Blake ate dinner together at Vitello's, an Italian restaurant in the Studio City neighborhood of Los Angeles, California. It was one of Blake's regular haunts, even earning him an eponymous dish on the menu, Fusilli e Minestra a la Robert Blake. Normally, when he came to Vitello's, he utilized the restaurant's valet service. Tonight, he parked his 1991 Dodge Stealth on the street, a block and a half away. After dinner, Blake and Bonnie headed to his car to drive home. But before driving off, Blake realized he'd forgotten something inside the restaurant. He left Bonnie to wait while he retrieved it, assuring her that he'd be right back. The next 10 minutes would change both of their lives forever. Blake returned to a horrific scene. Blood was everywhere. Bonnie had been shot twice and struggled with every breath. Blake frantically ran to a nearby house and they called 911. Blake found an off-duty nurse and enlisted her help, rushing her back to his car, pleading for her to do what she could to save his wife. But by the time Bonnie Lee Bakley reached St. Joseph Medical Center in Burbank at 10:15 p.m., less than 30 minutes from the time she'd been shot, she was dead. How should we determine a person's guilt? Do we defer to the evidence discovered by police or the verdict reached by a jury? And what happens when the evidence and the verdict don't line up? Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson, and this is Not Guilty, a Parcast original. Each week, we look at complicated criminal cases that test the limits of innocent until proven guilty. First, we'll follow the police as they gathered evidence and testimony to build a case and charge a suspect. In our next episode, we'll see that evidence play out in the courtroom and understand how the jury reached their verdict. This week, we're examining the 2001 murder of Bonnie Lee Bakley. We'll examine the investigation into her death, her colorful celebrity stalking past, and how police narrowed down their several suspects. Next week, we'll follow the resulting criminal trial, civil trial, and see for ourselves how the evidence matches up with the verdict. LAPD Detective Ronald Ito arrived on the scene in Studio City just before midnight on May 4th, 2001. He quickly got up to speed with the other officers, who had been working the area since they arrived around 10 p.m., They had already discovered a gun in a dumpster around the corner and believed it was the murder weapon, but the World War II era 9mm pistol had no serial number, which made it practically impossible to trace back to the owner. Ito noted that 68-year-old Robert Blake was in hysterics. Three times he asked for a glass of water, drained it, then puked it out onto the grass. It was either very good or very bad acting from the television star. Ito couldn't decide which. From his career experience, Ito knew that more often than not, a husband was connected to his wife's murder, and Blake was the last one to see Bonnie alive. Ito had also read tabloid headlines about Blake and his recent baby mama drama with the victim, 44-year-old Bonnie Lee Bakley. He hoped the actor would cooperate with the investigation. He had a reputation as being a bit temperamental. In the 5 years since O.J. Simpson had been found not guilty, discussions of celebrity privilege had continued in the Los Angeles justice system. Ito was aware of the possible impact Blake's stardom from his days as TV cop Beretta might have on the case. The burden of proof was that much heavier. Every step would be by the book. Robert was still visibly shaken, but agreed to accompany Ito back to the police station for an interview. The detective noted that once in the car, Blake's demeanor was calmer, and by the time they reached the station, he was explaining in extensive detail all of the many reasons why several people had good reason to come after his late wife. Blake didn't mince words with the detectives. Bonnie Lee Bakley was a con artist. He claimed that she had been running a Lonely Hearts scam for 30 years, writing letters to single men around the country, sending them naked pictures, pretending to be in love with them, all in exchange for money. Well, she didn't outright ask for cash. Instead, she let her pen pals know how grateful she would be to them for a little monetary assistance. Bonnie would claim she was short on rent, or her cat was sick, or her car needed to be repaired. If they would just be so kind as to send her a few hundred bucks, Bonnie would fix her car and immediately drive to meet them. Then she described in graphic detail how vigorously she would thank them for their help. Though, of course, she never did show up. Her next letter would say she got lost or ran out of gas money, or the repairs cost more than she expected. If only they could send a bit more money, or even better, a credit card number. Robert Blake told Detective Ito that he didn't know about his wife's letter service until after they married in November of 2000. Bonnie had only recently relocated to Los Angeles so they could raise their 11-month-old daughter, Rosie, together. Ito asked Blake to describe his relationship with Bonnie. How had they met? The pair were first introduced at comedian Chuck McCann's 64th birthday party in August of 1998. Another guest, screenwriter Will Jordan, had brought Bonnie as a date, but it was Blake that she left with. They drove back to her hotel in Hollywood. He said they did sleep together that night, but it wasn't a big deal. They started up a casual relationship. Bonnie, 42 at the time, lived in Memphis, Tennessee, but made frequent trips to Los Angeles to see 65-year-old Blake. In between visits, they talked on the phone and wrote letters. Regular letters, he stressed, not the dirty ones she wrote to schmucks. Bonnie told Blake then that she was on birth control, but he found out later that the pills she took were actually fertility drugs. By late 1999, she was pregnant. When Detective Ito asked Blake how he felt about the baby, Blake admitted that he had hoped Bonnie would get an abortion. Instead, she had the baby in June of 2000. They decided to get married a few months later, after hammering out a very aggressive prenuptial agreement. It precluded Bonnie from inheriting any of Blake's money or property at any point. She also signed a temporary custody agreement, granting Blake sole physical custody of their daughter. Bonnie's visits would be pre-scheduled and monitored. Blake assured Ito that he was glad now to have Rosie. She was a perfect little baby girl, and he loved her. But when he first found out Bonnie was pregnant, he had no interest in being a father again. He was 68 years old, with two grown children. He didn't need any more. This was why Rosie was now living with his daughter, 34-year-old Delina Blake. She had wanted kids of her own, but was unable to have any at the time. Now she had Rosie. It worked out for everyone. Ito asked Blake to walk him through the events of the evening. They went to dinner at Vitello's. Blake reported that before they left the house, Bonnie asked him to bring along one of his guns. She thought someone was stalking her and felt safer with his .38 nearby. They parked on the street, a little over a block away from the restaurant. The hostess sat them in Blake's customary corner booth around 8:30 p.m. After they ate, Blake paid the bill, his receipt timestamped 9:23 p.m. But when they reached his car, he realized that he'd left his jacket and the .38 caliber handgun in the booth. He left Bonnie to wait while he went back to the restaurant to retrieve them. While there, he asked for 2 glasses of water and drank them both. When he got back to the car at 9:38 p.m., he found Bonnie had been shot twice. She was barely alive. Frantic, Blake ran to the nearest house and banged on the door. He had to try more than one house before someone would answer. When they did, he insisted that they call 911. Police registered the call at 9:40 p.m. Blake then ran back to Vitello's to see if there was a doctor present. Terry Lorenzo Castaneda, a nurse, jumped up from her dinner to help. But by the time they reached Bonnie, she was bleeding from her eyes, nose, and mouth. Castaneda couldn't do anything. Then the lights and sirens arrived. By the time the ambulance reached the hospital at 10:15 p.m., Bonnie was dead on arrival. Blake then reiterated to Ito that Bonnie had pissed off a lot of people over the years with her letter scheme. She had plenty of reasons to think someone was following her. This was probably the work of some guy she bilked. Revenge. Ito wrote down the theory, but also noted how quickly Blake turned from visceral grief, moaning on the sidewalk, to trash-talking the deceased mother of his child. So far, it appeared to Detective Ito that Robert Blake had plenty of motive to kill his wife, and ample opportunity. He also had the means. Blake owned several guns in addition to the .38 caliber. But the forensics team found no significant gunpowder residue when they tested his hands, and no blood on his clothes. Bonnie was shot at point-blank range. It was unlikely that the shooter could have walked away free of any spatter. Frustrated, Ito sent Blake home. He knew he was missing something. He needed more information and more manpower. Ito reached out to another detective, Brian Tendall, to join the investigation. Together, the detectives spoke with Bonnie's younger sister in Dover, New Jersey, 39-year-old Marjorie Bakley. She had learned of the murder not even 4 hours after it occurred, when tabloid reporters arrived on her doorstep. Just after midnight on May 5, 2001, they asked her, "Who would have wanted to kill Mrs. Robert Blake?" Marjorie told the gossip rags the same thing she later told detectives. It was Robert Blake. Simple as that. She said, quote, "I didn't agree with what my sister was doing to him. There was a point when I felt sorry for what she was doing with the baby, but murder is wrong. There is a better way to deal with things," end quote. Detective Ito asked Marjorie to verify Blake's claims about the pregnancy. Was it true that Bonnie had intentionally become pregnant, contrary to Blake's wishes? Marjorie admitted that Bonnie had harbored the fantasy of marrying a celebrity for most of her life. When presented with the chance to finally bag a Hollywood man, she would have done whatever necessary, including getting knocked up. She tried to justify her sister's behavior, explaining that Bonnie's childhood was tumultuous. Their father was a drunk and molested her. Their mother was no better, a dour woman who referred to the children as stupid and ugly. She abandoned Bonnie at age 11, sending her to live with their maternal grandmother. It made Bonnie feel like no one wanted or loved her. Marjorie described their grandmother, Grammy Hall, as tight-fisted. She only bought secondhand clothes and didn't allow Bonnie to bathe daily, thinking it was a waste of water. Bonnie was teased at school for her old, worn-out clothes and rat's nest hair. It made her all the more determined to prove the bullies wrong by becoming a famous star, or at the very least, adjacent to a famous star. It took Marjorie a minute to recount for Ito all of the celebrities Bonnie had chased over the years. She spent the summer she turned 20 in Graceland, trying to catch a glimpse of Elvis, but then he died the next year in 1977. Dean Martin in the early 90s before he died, Gary Busey, Chuck McCann, Chubby Checker, all of the Frankies, Valley, Sinatra, and Avalon. She followed some for a few months, others for years. Starting in 1984, Bonnie spent nearly two decades stalking Jerry Lee Lewis, ingratiating herself in the outer rings of his circle. She befriended roadies, bodyguards, even Lewis's wife's personal secretary, anyone who might help her get close. Bonnie even tried to claim in 1993 that Lewis was the father of one of her daughters, naming her third child Jerry Lee, spelled J-E-R-I-L-E-E. When she leaked the story to tabloids, the singer ordered a paternity test and cleared his name. Detective Tendall pointed out the similarity in Bonnie's tactics with Lewis and with Blake. Marjorie agreed. Her sister was a determined woman who knew what she wanted. Bonnie had once told her that being around celebrity made her feel better than other people. It made her forget about her time as the smelly little girl in old clothes. Ito asked Marjorie if she remembered the last time they spoke. She told him they talked for several hours the morning of the murder, from 8 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Bonnie was panicky, terrified of Blake, and certain he wanted to kill her, but was trying to play off her fear with humor. She instructed Marjorie which tabloid reporter she wanted to write her obituary and what headshots to use for the magazines. Ito asked why Bonnie thought Blake was after her. Marjorie said it came straight from the horse's mouth. Apparently, the night before her murder, they'd gotten into an argument. He told Bonnie, quote, "I've got a bullet with your name on it," end quote. Bonnie insisted that she wasn't just some bimbo he could push around. She said, quote, "I must be kind of smart. I got you to finally marry me. I got myself a movie star and nobody thought I could do it," end quote. According to Marjorie, Blake fired back, quote, "Girl, you better remember who you are dealing with. I'll kill your ass," end quote. Coming up, Detectives Ito and Tendall learn more about Bonnie's letter scheme and try to connect the murder weapon to a suspect.